Well, good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. We have a healthcare topic for you this morning, something that we've done off and on quite a few years now, and generally with the same guy who is here sitting with me this morning. His name is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist, which means he's a doctor who specializes in the foot and the ankle, nothing above that. And from time to time here now, over low these many years, he's been here to talk a little bit about foot health and answer questions. And that is what we will do. Every once in a while, we pick a particular body part and talk about that. We have some people who are more generalist who deal with everything, but specific things we'd like to try to do. And the foot was one of those we picked out, recognizing that it can be a source of problems. If your feet hurt, it can be pretty tough to do what you need to do in life. And so if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Now, one caution, though, I do want to say, and I say it every time here, we have a doctor on the show. We can't diagnose over the telephone. If you have a real problem, you need to pursue that with a doctor that you can see and who can see you. But you can start out asking some basic questions, and I know that he'll try to help you out and maybe add to your knowledge about the foot and foot issues. So that's what we're up to here this morning in this hour, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Any point here, people have questions, they can call. Thanks very much for being here again.
That's nice to be here.
Appreciate it.
It's kind of interesting. You mentioned about how many years I've been doing this. I was going through some boxes, and I found a cassette tape. What tells you how long that is, because, my God, there's nothing to play that with. But it was 1982 was the first time I was here.
Well, I know it's been a long time. And I think and you were actually had a private practice when we started out.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, well,
I'm still here. My God, I can't believe it. So.
Glad for all of the years of shows that you've done with us. Well, I don't know. It's as a general way of starting out. I was wondering, when you look at foot problems, What percentage you might just say are kind of normal wear and tear? You know, the foot takes a lot of pounding and a lot of weight. That may be kind of age related. Mm-hmm. And to what extent are they things that have to do with the feature of the foot that you were just kind of born with, and that you know you just inherited those structures, and mm-hmm. then they can go on to cause problems.
Well, it's an interesting question. I guess that it's based on structure. And certainly you can have a person who has a structure that would predispose them to certain problems, but if you don't stress that structure, then they don't come up with those problems. So it is more complicated to say, you know, whether it's purely structure or purely the type of stress that's placed on the foot throughout the course of the day, that it all goes together. You can have some people who have a great perfect structure, and they can go ahead and stress their foot as much as they want, and they really don't have any problems. So I think it's probably a combination of both.
Mm-hmm. How much of foot problems are shoe-related?
I think a lot of them are shoe-related, and it's getting a little bit worse now nowadays. I mean, people, again, with the economy the way it is, certain things are kind of set aside, and that's probably one of them. And somebody who, let's say, well, maybe I'll replace my shoes every 6 months or a year, saying, well, yeah, maybe these aren't so bad. I'll go ahead and continue using them. But yes, if you have a shoe that's broken down, it can go ahead and give you a significant amount of problems, because you can take a normal foot, put it in a broken down shoe, and it will exhibit certain symptoms related to that.
Yeah, and I suppose that goes for it. It could be you would say, well, at one time, I thought this was a good shoe, well made shoe. I spent some significant money on this because that was important to me. You know, good shoes. But if you wear them till they're falling apart, they're not going to do what you want.
True. And also, sometimes the people say, well, I'm going to go ahead and maybe I'm going to buy a shoe that's maybe not so expensive. That's not exactly wise, because you certainly get what you pay for, and it can be a situation where spend a little bit more money for a shoe, the construction of the shoe is a little bit better, it will actually last you a lot longer than the cheap shoe, where you might have a particular shoe that will last very and perform well throughout the course of a year, and you buy a cheaper shoe, and it may only last 3 months and then break down. So but if you go ahead and add that up, it's actually cheaper in the long run to buy the more expensive, well-constructed shoe.
Okay. Well, we got one caller here to start off, a couple of callers to start us off. And the first, I think, is in Champaign. That is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the genetic piece. Well, I inherited flat feet from my dad, and so, of course, I've had all kinds of issues, but I'm dealing with them. But now I'm worried about my kids. When do you figure out, are they going to have a same kind of problem, and is there any way to avoid that kind of a genetic problem, or at least to, you know, put them in shoes or start doing something with their feet early on so that they don't have, you know, similar kinds of problems?
Well, it's really best to actually have them looked at, because it's one of those situations where if they do have a tendency to have that significant flat foot abnormality, then what we'd like to do is to go ahead and control the position of the foot so that they don't end up with the compensatory changes that take place mostly in the soft tissue that give us problems as they mature and grow. So we do like to go ahead and control them for that particular reason. Now, it's not a situation where, let's say, if you put them in a support and parents always say, when are they're gonna outgrow this, and as they grow, their foot's gonna be normal. No, I kind of look upon the support like eyeglasses for the feet, and you don't say, well, I'm going to go ahead and wear these glasses for 6 months, then my eyes are going to be healed. No, it's a situation, again, where you're going to go ahead and maintain the position, the normal position of the foot, so that they don't go ahead and have problems in the future. And not every child is going to have that flat foot deformity as well. So
okay.
It's worthwhile to go ahead and see, is a bony structural problem that's given the flat foot? Is it a tightness in some of the other muscular structures that you can go ahead and do something to relieve the tension that's causing the flat foot? So it's good to assess it and then kind of go from there.
And what age is the best?
Really earlier the better.
Oh.
It's really something that anywhere from 2 years on.
Okay. Well, that's good. Okay. So then just getting them evaluated and seeing if it is causing any issues at this point.
Yeah, and even if it isn't causing any issues, it depends on the severity, because a lot of times with kids, you know, they're not necessarily complaining about, you know, symptoms, but it's something to go ahead and see if they have the structural abnormalities and then try to treat them early.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Thanks for your help.
All right. Thank you. And we will go next to someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello. Is there a caller there in Urbana, line two? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
My question is about an ingrown toenail. And it's been, I've been having problems with it for a long time. And it's on my big toe on my left foot. And I keep trying to round off the corner so it won't push into the skin,
mm-hmm.
but it still does.
Right, and that's because of the fact that it's really not a matter of necessarily how you cut the toenail or trim the nail. It's a matter of the shape of the toenail itself. So it's something that actually can be fixed. What we usually do in those situations is actually remove the side of the toenail that's growing down and in, and remove it back to the spot where it actually grows, and locally kill the cells that produce that nail in that particular area. The rest of the nail grows out fine, but we just destroy the growth in that particular spot. So we remove the section of the nail that's pushing down in the skin as it grows out, and that's really the only way that you can kind of permanently correct that particular problem.
But I'm 80 years old.
Right.
Why is it that I have, you know, for 78 years, I didn't have this problem?
It's actually because of the fact that the shape of the toenails, their thickness, texture, etc., can change over time. You got to remember, toenail is a specialized skin appendage, just like hair is. So it's made out of keratin, just like the hair shaft is, and just like hair, it can go ahead and change in color, texture, etc., as we age. And people say, well, geez, you know, why would it just be one? Well, just like every single hair on the top of your head doesn't go ahead and turn gray all at once, just individual ones do. And you can have changes in that in the shape of the toenail just based on age.
So that's the only solution is to have that cut back.
Well, there's
for you to do something. However you do that,
either that or periodically trim the nail back to such an extent where you relieve the pressure against the skin. But as that nail grows out again, then the pressure returns. So there's an option in terms of palliative care where you do it every once in a while, or trying to do it permanently.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Now, there's something that you can use at the next party, next cocktail party you're at. You could sidle up to the person next to you and say, did you know that your toenails and your hair are actually of the same thing?
And it's true. People, for some reason, think of nails, fingernails and toenails are related to bone. They're not related to bone at all. They're just... they're related to the skin more than anything else.
All right. Well, other questions are welcome. Do you mean to talk a little bit more about flat feet? Does that truly mean that a person has no arch, or just that it's very small?
Well, or very flexible, where they're off weight bearing and you look at their foot and it's perfectly fine, and they stand on it, and boy, it flattens out like a pancake. Or that person which is a flexible flat foot, versus the person who you look and boy, you know, they're... whether they're standing on it or they're not, it's flat. So there's various reasons for a flat foot, and whether it's a structural problem in terms of the bony architecture, or is it a compensation for some soft tissue problems. One of the main ones is tightness of the calf muscle, and through the mechanics of walking, basically you have to have 10 degrees of dorsiflexion of the foot on the leg at mid-stance phase of gait. It's one of those, it's just the rules, you have to have that to walk on 2 feet. If you don't have that because of tightness in that particular structure, the body compensates for that by pronating the foot, because then as a result of that and flattening out the foot, it'll gain some of that particular motion. So there's a situation where someone can stand and walk and function. They have a perfectly normal bony architecture of the foot, but because of that soft tissue problem, they exhibit all those particular problems with excessive flat foot. So, as I said, there's a lot of, you know, saying someone has a flat foot doesn't mean that much. You know, why is the foot flat?
Uh-huh. So. And generally speaking, do you deal with that by putting them into a shoe that has an arch that will then make the foot do that arch thing?
It depends. You know, if it's a rigid structural flat foot, they can't tolerate that, no. So there's no putting an arch in. And a lot of times those patients are asymptomatic. They don't have a problem at all. If someone has a flexible flat foot where the foot collapses, then you can go ahead and the idea is to, you know, again, figure out why it does that and address that, whether it be stretching exercises to increase the flexibility in that calf muscle, whether it be utilizing a heel lift and support to go ahead and try to decrease the pull of that muscle so the foot doesn't have to compensate for that, or do you go ahead and surgically go ahead and lengthen that particular muscle so as to not have those particular problems. Mm. It's interesting in kids sometimes when you see that in children, how you can have a child who has a really tight gastroc muscle and their first calf muscle, and as they stand, boy, their foot really flattens out. They fail going ahead and doing their stretching exercises, surgically going in and do the release of the muscle, and they stand there and they have no flat foot anymore. So just by going ahead and taking care of that particular problem.
So, that it ends
so it's
up
pretty
not,
interesting.
And it's not really a foot. I mean, ultimately
right.
It's not a foot
no.
thing at all.
No. The foot was just doing what it was supposed to do in terms of compensation for another problem.
Yeah. Mm, okay. So. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. And next with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
This might lead right into my question. I used to have plantar fasciitis in the foot I'm talking about, and that's gone away. And ever since then, I've worn very good shoes. Dance goes most of the time. And now I find, though, that I still have a very short calf, and I have terrible pain in my heel. So no more the plantar fasciitis in the center arch, but now terrible pain in the heel. Is that, you think, also due to this shortened calf muscle?
Certainly could be. You know, that's one of those situations where when you talk about plantar fasciitis, a majority of plantar fascia pain is heel pain. You can see it in the arch as well, but a majority of it is right there in the bottom of the heel and just a little past that point toward the toes where the plantar fascia attaches.
Well, mine wasn't there because you could hit mine right in the center and have mm-hmm. me, you know, hit the roof. But I can't touch any part of my heel and feel pain, but it's deep in there.
Right. And, it certainly could be, secondary to some of the problems with tightness of the calf muscle. Though that dance goes, it's a good shoe for that particular problem because of the relative heel height that it has kind of decreases the pull of the tendon, and the shape of the sole is such that it's a pretty extensive rocker, so it decreases the pull on the plantar fascia too. So, that's something that you'd have to look at and see what's going on.
But if you still have chronic pain, then you think there's something else with the tendon attaching at the bottom of the foot, where this whole calf is being too short?
Right. It certainly could be.
Okay, thank you.
You're
all right. And next caller is in Monticello, line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm calling because 10 years ago I was diagnosed with Charcot, and I can't tell much difference except the bottom of my foot I feel bones that aren't pushed through. But what can develop with Charcot, and how serious is it? Tell me all about Charcot. It ends with O-T, Charcot.
Well, before you hang up, though, is it Charcot secondary to a neuropathy or like diabetes, something of that nature?
Well, I do have diabetes, and I do have neuropathy, if that
okay.
means no feeling.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting problem. Charcot arthropathy is basically a complication of the neuropathy more than necessarily the diabetes. You can see it in non-diabetic patients as well, and it's because of the lack of sensation. And what happens is you basically have a loss of sensation, and at the same token, you can have microtrauma to a number of the bones in the foot itself. So then also at the same token, we have an increase in blood supply to those particular areas in response to the microtrauma. And then what happens is basically you then get a situation where the bones themselves tend to soften as a result of the increase in blood flow to those particular spots.
Okay.
So then you get a collapse of the bones themselves as a result of that. So we lose that bony architecture, especially the arch, and then you get a collapse of usually the midfoot. And then as a result of that, you go ahead and the whole foot collapses. It's one of those situations where it goes through various stages. Usually initially it's something it's usually always painless because you don't have the sensation, but it's usually that initial stage where red, hot, and swollen. And many times people think it's bone infection or fracture or something of that nature. And certainly it can appear that there's multiple fractures in those areas. And it's important to recognize the Charcot problem early so that you offload it and rest it to try to maintain it. And then usually the problem itself will burn itself out. And as long as you support the foot in the proper position and offload it, the bone usually will reform and you have a minimum amount of deformity. If you continue to walk on it and it continues to collapse, then you're kind of in that situation where then the bones will reform but in the abnormal position. So in those cases, then sometimes you have to go through the reconstruction of the foot secondary to the Charcot arthropathy, which can be done, but it's certainly much more complicated than trying to support it prior to the breakdown.
Well, I was given a brace about 10 years ago that ultimately rests on my kneecap.
Right.
You know,
right.
And what will that brace do, and what's it supposed to do?
Well, that's a patellar tendon-bearing brace, and it's supposed to go ahead and take the weight off of the foot and have it weight being borne right underneath the kneecap. Sometimes that's effective, sometimes it's not. But then there's lots of different ankle-foot orthosis that can be used for that particular problem.
Okay. Is my ankle level to collapse or break if I walk without the brace. I wouldn't walk across the room without it. But have I become accustomed to it that I should have it always on?
Yes, you should probably always have it on. Trying to keep all the rest of the joints from having too much stress placed on them.
Well, thanks for your info. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Hi, Feller.
I guest this morning here on Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. That means he's a doctor who specializes in dealing with the foot. And if you have questions about your feet, you can give us a call, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about shoes and about how it's maybe, if you can, you know, get the best quality shoe that you can. But given that everybody's foot is different, mm-hmm. you know, maybe some people have found a particular brand of shoe that works well for them. And all shoes are all different. They're built on a different pattern, mm-hmm. and some have big arches and some have small arches. And, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. How, if you're looking at a shoe, is there anything that you can look for or look at that would be a good tip that it's a good shoe and that it might be a good shoe for you?
Yeah, there's certain rules as far as shoe construction that you like to go ahead and look at. It's kind of difficult to do over on the radio, but what you look first of is the degree of basically three things. One, you want to have the shoe flexible where it's supposed to be flexible, and that is where the toes bend. So you want to pick up the shoe and actually take your finger and put it on the toe of the shoe, hold the rest of the heel of the shoe in your one hand and push up. And you want to make sure that the shoe bends where the foot bends. It's pretty simple. And it should mm-hmm. have a kind of minimum amount of force to go ahead and cause it to bend. Very important in children's shoes. Got to remember that if you have a child that weighs, 22 pounds and it takes 32 pounds to bend it, then obviously the child's going to walk very clumsily. So that way I always get that, oh, boy, they fall down when they walk. Well, that's like putting a ski boot on you and you have a new walk. Well, you're pretty clumsy too. Yeah. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when you push up on that particular area, it should bend where the foot bends, but it also should not bend behind that. So it should be pretty rigid through the area of the arch of the foot or arch of the shoe. So this is something that's very interesting. You go ahead and take a lot of shoes and you go ahead and do that and you push and lo and behold, it bends right through the middle of the shoe. Uh-huh. So that's not a very stable shoe, so you don't want that. So the other thing you look at is in the heel counter of the shoe, which is the back of the shoe that encompasses the heel itself. And you want that pretty rigid so that it'll hold the heel in its proper position. Uh-huh. And the third thing is what's called torsional rigidity, where you want to twist the shoe, and you want to make sure that it may twist in the toe box of the shoe, but the rest of the shoe, it remains pretty stable. So those are the basic things you look at in terms of quality of footwear and to go ahead and try to utilize a shoe that will go ahead and give you those particular characteristics. It's very interesting to do that in the shoe store and see how frequently that doesn't mean that it's the most expensive shoe. And sometimes the very expensive shoes fail those particular tests. So it's good to go ahead and do those things.
So in terms of two things, and I've got callers here, I'll get right back to two things. In terms of fit, should the heel cup, that part at the back mm-hmm. of your shoe where your heel goes, should that, you know, how snugly should it hold your heel?
Actually, there should be a pretty good amount of room back there. So one of the times people say, oh, boy, you know, that shoe was so loose, I got blisters. Frequently, you get blisters because it's too tight. Uh-huh. And so that doesn't allow the heel to move inside of the shoe. And again, if you have a shoe that's really flexible where your foot bends, then you don't have that situation where as you're on the toes of the foot that the forces are trying to go ahead and pull that, you pull your heel out of the shoe. So those are the important things.
Okay.
So yes, in fit, you know, again, width, length, and depth of the toe box, those are things that are important to look at.
Well, that's the other thing. If you've gone to some place where there is someone who is actually trying to fit mm-hmm. you, so what they do is they say, okay, you put on the shoe, and they have you stand up. And what this person does then is they pinch in at the toe,
right.
And what they're trying to do is see if they can feel where your toe is in there. And so then, so how much room do you want to have between your, you know, your big toe
that's the
toe of the shoe?
That's your rule of thumb.
That's your rule of thumb.
So you have to, about a thumb's width between the end of your longest toe and the end of the toe box of the shoe.
Is that what they call it, the rule of thumb?
Well, I call it the rule of thumb.
Okay.
I'm sure somebody else does as well. But it's a good generality to go ahead and say now. But more importantly also is the shape of the toe box. You know, everybody's feet are different. You know, if you're like me, I have Fred Flintstone feet, so they're square. So I have to wear a shoe that's pretty square.
Pretty square, yeah.
So if you have a foot that is, you know, fairly tapered, you can go ahead and do that too. But that's why someone has to measure, you know, your foot and to go ahead and put it into the can't fit the square peg in the round hole.
Well, I think a long time ago we were talking about this, and you said something like, you know, really the best shoe is the shoe that's shaped like a foot.
Right.
And you're looking at a lot of shoes, they're not shaped like feet.
No, not shaped like feet. So, yes.
All right. Well, let's talk to some other folks here, and we have a number of them. We'll take them in order, starting with line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about the criteria for use of a bone stimulator on an uncomplicated ankle fracture. What are the pros and cons of the use of a bone stimulator?
Well, you know, most of the time, you know, if there's no predisposing factors for someone that would have complications in healing, that immobilization is the most important thing in regards to fracture healing, that you don't have movement at the fracture site. So if you don't have any movement at the fracture site, then it will go ahead and allow it to heal. So usually the bone stimulators aren't necessarily used as a common course unless there would be some other complications to patient had problems with non-union or delayed union in the past, other issues. But most of the times that wouldn't be used unless you do see a situation where you would have a delayed union.
And what do you consider delayed union?
Well, in terms of, let's say, anywhere from 12 to 16 weeks out, if you haven't had any healing during that particular period of time, then you might consider the bone stimulator.
Okay. So you would say after 4 months?
Probably. That would certainly. And then a lot of times you'll consider also doing a bone scan in those particular areas to go ahead and see what the bone looks like on either side of the fracture, whether you have viable bone on either side of that as well. So there's that just in terms of having someone go ahead and manage the fracture.
And just in terms of any sort of fracture, whether it's an ankle or an arm or anything, do you find that encouraging extra calcium, do you really think that makes any difference in terms of bone healing, or is it just the immobility?
Well, certainly it doesn't hurt, but the immobilization is the most important thing.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Very good. And we'll continue. And then the next caller is also in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi. I have that toenail fungus, and I have had it for years, and it doesn't really bother me. But when I was a kid, we did a lot of different things to try and get rid of it, and nothing really worked. And now I have kids, and I'm worried one of them is sort of starting to develop it, and as I say, it doesn't bother me, but I don't really want them to have it. So I'm wondering, is there any treatment nowadays that works? They had me on all kinds of different antibiotics and all kinds of stuff when I was a kid, and nothing really did anything for it.
Well, the question is whether, number one, it was truly a fungus, and that's something that as long as someone took samples of the nail plate or the material out of the nail bed and confirmed the presence of fungi, That's the first thing. So I assume
that it did, because I went to a couple different podiatrists at the time, but this was years ago, as they say.
So that's the thing, is there can be some dystrophic nails that look like that aren't fungus. So that'd be the first thing. And you know, it's one of those things, I think, that what's going to happen out in years to come, we're going to find out that the reason why these people have these chronic nail infections is the fact that they are their immune system does not recognize that particular fungus as a threat, and they don't have any natural immunity against it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's – and I do see it, as you said, you see it in families where, you know, the grandma, grandpa, the, you know, aunts, uncles, they all have this particular problem. Sometimes they'll have it on their
– my family.
Sometimes they'll have it on their fingernails as well as toenails, but – and even when we utilize oral antifungal medication for these problems, we may see some success in regards to elimination of the problem, but then we look at maybe five years down the road, and our reoccurrence rate is very high. So it just comes back because, again, they don't have any ability to fight off the infection. So I don't know what to tell you. It's a problem, and trying to go ahead and protect children from having this, I don't know. It's hard for me to say, oh, you need to go ahead and start using topical antifungals on kids and use it forever. Mm-hmm. The good thing about it is it's mostly a cosmetic issue because it doesn't really usually cause any other problems besides that. As I said, one of these days we're probably going to find out exactly what the reason for it is and maybe be able to address it at that time. But right now, there's not much else out there. Now, I was at a meeting recently with an infectious disease specialist, and he was saying that there's some new things on the horizon in regards to treatment of fungal infection to nails, but it's probably not going to be around for probably 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
So there may be something else. But again, I'm still – my problem is I don't care how you treat it. It's just going to come back.
I'm wondering what you think of any of the folk remedies that go around. Like people have said, use Vicks on
right. It
or cornmeal.
Cornmeal probably wouldn't be the best thing because that's how you grow it in the lab.
Because
it's actually grown on corn media, so that would probably not be like kerosene on the fire. But yes, there's a million different things. Boy, I think I've heard them all.
And you don't see any real help with
tea tree oil, Vicks salve, Listerine, and chlorine bleach. I don't think any of them really are effective.
Okay, well, I will keep my ears open about treatments in the future. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thank you for the call. And the next caller is, again, someone in Champaign, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I have a stress fracture in my foot, and I wondered, it's been there for a long time, and when I went to my doctor initially and it was x-rayed, they didn't see anything, so he said, well, it must be a stress fracture, and put me in one of those little boot things, but it really didn't go away. So I just was wondering, do they take a long, long time to heal, or what do you do with them?
Well, is this in one of the metatarsal bones, one of the long bones of the foot?
On the top.
Well, it's as I said, it's no different than any other fracture, and again, immobilization is what allows it to heal. And a lot of times with these particular stress fractures, there's something that comes up over time, and the patient doesn't necessarily always point to, I didn't jump off a curb, one day it started to become swollen and sore, and it's just persisted at doing that.
Mine's not swollen at all, it's just sore.
Well,
but it also is on the foot. I have a bad knee on the other side, a badly arthritic knee, and so I figured probably on the other leg because I'm using it more.
The other thing is follow-up x-rays are important. Obviously, if it's a true stress fracture, you're going to see x-ray changes in the bone as a result of the body trying to heal it.
Yeah, he said they didn't see anything.
Then if you didn't see anything, it's probably not there.
Hmm.
So it may not be a stress fracture causing the pain.
Hmm.
So it may be something else. So those are things, too, that you can confirm by, again, bone scan, MRI, things like that, or any other imaging studies to go ahead and see if there is any pathology in the bone that's related to fracture. But if it's been there, let's say for 2 or 3 months, if it is a stress fracture, it's going to show up on a plain film.
Well, it's been a year and a couple of months.
Then it's probably not a stress fracture.
Okay. Oh, try the doctor. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. We're talking about the feet and foot care and foot problems. And if you have questions, call us. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Urbana is next. Line 1. Hello.
Hi. First, I want to say thank you very much for your program. I love hearing it. And my question is as follows. My mom has these bones. I can't really explain exactly. I don't know the name, but they are grown bones that are where the toe is bending inside the foot,
mm-hmm.
And they're really big, and they're growing as the time goes by. So I was wondering what can – I don't have them, but my grandmother also had them. And I was wondering what can I do in order to avoid this situation, not to have those bones going out. So it's very difficult then to fit a shoe because you have just a bone sticking out from the side of the foot where the toe is bending, basically.
Right. You're talking about the bunion deformity.
Yeah, I don't know the name.
Right, which is where the big toe goes over on one side and the first metatarsal drifts in the other direction. It is one of those things, again, that a lot of times is a structural abnormality. People can inherit the foot structure that predisposes them to forming the bunion. And so usually you will see that if the patient's going to have that particular problem, you're usually going to see it fairly early. So if someone's strong family history as they're 19 to 20 years old, you're going to see a tendency to have to form the bunion. If as time goes on you don't see it, most likely you're not going to have that particular problem. Uh-huh. So again, utilization of a shoe that fits well is helpful, but the bunion isn't caused by bad fitting shoes. It's more of a structural abnormality. So not everybody in the family is going to go ahead and have that particular problem. So let's say if you're 45, 50 years old and your toes are nice and straight, most likely you're not going to go ahead and have that particular problem.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Is there any way to relieve? Because they are sometimes aching, and is there any way that my mom can relieve them?
Remedies? Only by taking the pressure off that spot. And it's, again, proper shoes, et cetera, so that there's no pressure on those particular areas. And ultimately, a lot of times patients ask me, can you put a brace on there to straighten that toe out? No, surgically you have to go ahead and correct it by moving the bone.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So are you talking about the kind of a problem where sometimes if you look at someone's foot that actually their toes, rather than sitting really nicely, one next to another, mm-hmm. that they're overlapping?
Well, it's only the big toe.
Okay,
so the big toe kind of comes over in this particular way.
The next one over.
Right, actually the first metatarsal bone, which is the first long bone of the foot, actually drifts toward the midline of the body, and the toe goes over in the other particular direction. So that's the deformity, and again, trying to treat that particular problem it usually requires surgical intervention in regards to realigning everything. Uh-huh.
And then you see people who have that particular problem also then the little toe is way going off
not necessarily. Certainly you can have a situation where as the big toe drifts and it impinges on the alignment of the rest of the toes, it can go ahead and wreak havoc with all the structures that are trying to keep the toes nice and straight, but not necessarily. That's why sometimes you'll see where the second toe starts to overlap the big toe, and then the rest of them are okay. But you will see on certain occasions where they all tend to drift laterally. So, and that's one of the things we always talk about in terms of when do you not treat the problem conservatively? When do you consider surgery for those particular areas? And that's another kind of one of those things. If it really starts to affect all the lesser digits as well, and just the total function of the foot, then you really have to go ahead and straighten really repair the bunion to reestablish the normal mechanics of the foot, so as you don't have to go through a whole big reconstruction in the future.
Okay. Next, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello. Is the caller there, line one in Urbana? Okay, how about we go to line two in Urbana? Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was hearing him talk about bunion, and I had bunion on both of my toes, and I didn't get them until I got in my 40s. Mm-hmm. And I had them fixed, surgically. They took out a piece of the bone, straightened them out, and everything. But I ran and danced a lot when I was young, and why would I get those so late in life? I mean, nobody in my family has it. I have,
right.
I'm in a family of seven kids.
Mm-hmm.
My parents don't have that problem. I don't know.
Well, it's true. You know, as I said, there's some families or there are some situations where it does run in the family, but there's other situations where it will just come about as a result of the biomechanical abnormalities in the foot. So, and most of the time, the tendency to or I should say the actual bunion that's there, it's in various degrees. I see patients that I tell them all the time. I said, well, there's a mild bunion deformity. They think I'm crazy. You know, there's nothing there. Well, it's really there, but you don't necessarily notice it. So
is it because of arthritis? Can arthritis cause that?
But I would say, you know, I would say no. And certainly in cases where if you have rheumatoid disease, we will see a bunion develop as a result of the disease process, but most of the time, it's not necessarily an arthritic problem. It's more, as I said, of a structural abnormality in the changes that take place in the joint itself as a result of the compensation for that structural abnormality.
Oh, I see, because it never wouldn't give me any problem until I hit probably about 40, 44, something
right.
like that,
mm-hmm.
and then boom, I got this foot problem.
Because it usually doesn't come up overnight. It's something that's there. And
so you're saying it's inherited?
Not as I said. I mean, it's not a situation where everyone who has that particular problem, or if it's in the family, that everyone in the family is going to have that particular condition. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I'm losing the heel in the back. Isn't that terrible? I can't wear hardly any shoes. My heel is I'm losing it.
You're losing your heel. Huh?
It's getting thinner. You know what I mean? So when I put shoes on, they slip off the back of the heel, and they fit the foot. If I get them bigger, I can't wear them. If I get them smaller, they're too tight. You know, so it's the craziest thing.
It can be a problem.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Belgium. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. In your earlier discussion, you were talking about quality shoes, and I can only highly recommend that too. I buy what's called Finn Comfort, which are a German shoe, and they wear like iron, and they feel so good from the moment you put them on to the day you take them off. But the question I really have with you is, I've noticed that there's almost no companies in the United States that produce this quality of shoe. Do you know of one?
Boy, you know, it's true. You know, it's one of those situations where, as you well know, if you're a Finn Comfort fan, that you have to bring a wheelbarrow full of money when you buy them.
Oh, yes.
So that's probably one of the reasons. I mean, they're a great shoe, very well made. The interior is lined with leather. I mean, but they're not inexpensive. So if you look at the, what market is that shoe made for? I mean, it's certainly if you had an American company that was just producing that particular shoe. There's some good quality shoe companies still, you know, Allen Edmonds, even the Florsheim, you know, there's certain ones that are still being made, but they're very expensive. I do like the Finn Comforts as well, but, you know, they're just, there's not many people are going to go ahead and spend $250 for a pair of shoes.
Yeah. And that's on sale.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. On to Bloomington, Illinois, line four. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yes.
Say in the winter months, I notice my right toe's very tender and slightly swollen. And when the warm weather comes, it tends to go away. But it just seems to be on the right foot.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just very, very tender. What would that be? I was told once it might be like a circulation problem.
Do you have any color changes to those toes also? They get a little bit brighter red or
Yeah.
Any history of frostbite in the past?
Boy, not that I can recall, but maybe as a kid.
You know, certainly that's what that sounds like. A lot of times we'll have patients, especially in the colder months, they have problems with usually their toes, mostly the tips of the toes and the bottom portion of the toe underneath the toenail, and they will turn colors. They'll become uncomfortable, and frequently it's in reaction to the cold. Now circulation, it's easy to test if somebody has good peripheral circulation, but a lot of times we find this as secondary to response to old cold injuries. And it's kind of funny, after they've had this particular insult, they don't have to have really cold temperatures. It can be, you know, 35, 45 degrees and the toes react to that particular temperature, especially if someone has a tendency, if their feet sweat a little bit more than usual. Then the idea in terms of treating those problems are making sure that they wear, you know, a good sock with wicking characteristics so that they keep their skin dry, and utilize powder to keep the skin dry, because then you lose all the insulation quality of the shoe and the sock if they do get wet, and you just have to be really careful about keeping them warm.
I see. So it could be something that simple. I was a little worried because I read some article about circulation and I don't know if it was diabetes, but they said eventually, you know, you can, even in severe cases, it can lead to amputation. And one thing to look for is if your toenails don't grow very much.
Well, the thing is, and that's something, again, that should be checked out. Any you know, your primary care physician would be more than happy to assess your circulation, easy to see. And if that would not be the problem, then I would think that keeping them warm would be the best way to go.
How do you test circulation?
You just simple things like feeling the pulses. There's two places for feeling pulses in the foot. Going ahead and pressing on the end of the toe to see how long it takes it to refill after it blanches. Assessing the quality of the skin, how much digital hair growth there is, quality of the toenails. So it takes someone who is trained to do that 10 seconds to figure it out. But
what if your toenails aren't growing much? They just don't grow.
If they don't grow, that could be a sign of bad circulation as well.
Is that something to worry about?
I would, you know, again, if you have that situation where you have some problems with the tips of the toes and decrease in the rate of growth of toenails, especially if it's, you know, they don't grow on the right and they grow on the left, then it would be worthwhile to talk to somebody about having them just say, hey, how good's my circulation in my feet?
Well, now what if they say it's poor circulation, what can you do to get better?
Well, then you have to see why it's poor, and if is it a blockage, you know, then it has to do some further testing to go ahead and see.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll get at least one more caller here, someone in Chicago on our line number 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I have been a jogger for some years and have gone through many different kinds of shoes. And you read many different things in the jogging and running magazines about how to select shoes. Some saying that even the cheapest shoe is fine. Some saying, well, you have to have the most expensive shoe. I was wondering if you could give just some general information on what you would look for in a running shoe. I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
As far as the jogging shoe, it's not much different than the assessment of a regular shoe. I am a kind of a believer in specialty shoes, too. So, you know, it's also one of those situations where if you're doing a lot of cross training, you probably should be in a cross training shoe because of the side-to-side stability of that particular shoe. But as far as and also in the running shoe, a lot of it has to do with the terrain you're running on, mileage that you're putting in, physical characteristics of the runner in terms of their weight, in terms of their running style and technique as well. If those are taken into account as of somebody a 4-foot striker, mid-foot striker, heel striker, and those are things that then you would go ahead and kind of tailor the particular construction of the shoe to those particular factors. But still keeping in mind the importance of the stability of the shoe, and especially through the midfoot. I've seen a lot of shoes that we've talked about before about how they are not very flexible, or should say they're too flexible through the area of the midfoot. And that's something that can easily be assessed by just trying to bend the shoe, and it should only bend where the toes bend. And that's something to look at.
All right. We're just about the point we have to finish up. Can you give us about a minute on foot odor?
No. Foot odor?
Yes.
Oh. It's real simple. Foot odor is kind of not much different than odor anywhere else, except the fact that the foot produces probably about a third of a cup of fluid a day. And, of course, it's stuck in that particular area. So it's absorbed by the sock, absorbed by the lining and materials of the shoes, and it's got nowhere to go. So what happens in that situation, the bacteria that normally live on the skin, we kind of use that sweat as a food source and produce these organic acids, and these organic acids smell. So you can treat it by either trying to ventilate the shoe and the foot well, or you try to decrease the bacterial content on the skin by using antibacterial soap that decreases the amount of bacteria, which decreases that as well. Or you can decrease the amount of sweat by using antiperspirants. Antiperspirant that works under the arm works on the foot as well. So you can go ahead and use that.
Does the choice of the material that your sock is made of, does that make
a difference? I mean, it's always nice to have something that wicks the material away from the skin, and cotton is not a good one to do that. You know, so some of the other materials are better. But the biggest thing is perspiration too, is using an antiperspirant.
Okay. What do you think about that recommendation? Some people say you really should have, if you can, have a couple of pair of shoes and not wear the same pair every day.
Well, yeah, obviously, especially if your feet tend to sweat, obviously when you put your foot in the shoe in the morning, after taking off at night, you're putting it in a wet shoe.
Yeah.
So the shoe would last longer because you don't deteriorate the materials of the shoe, and it certainly helps in terms of being able to absorb that moisture we're talking about and then dry it out later.
All right. Our guest, Dr. Robert Bourne, he's a podiatrist at Carr Clinic in Urbana. Every once in a while, he stops by here and we talk about the feet. Hey, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.